From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. The FBI is investigating Russian election hacking, and the scope of that investigation includes whether there were ties between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. That was the surprising testimony given today by FBI Director James Comey before the House Intelligence Committee. Here's exactly what Comey said.
I have been authorized by the Department of Justice to confirm that the FBI, as part of our counterintelligence mission, is investigating the Russian government's efforts to interfere in the 2016 presidential election. And that includes investigating the nature of any links between individuals associated with the Trump campaign and the Russian government, and whether there was any coordination between the campaign and Russia's efforts.
Comey said the FBI began its investigation in July. These are the first congressional hearings on the matter. The House Intelligence Committee had a lot of ground to cover. Let's hear some extended portions of the hearing, first from Republican Chairman Devin Nunes. He spelled out his concerns.
First, what actions did Russia undertake against the United States during the 2016 election campaign? And did anyone from a political campaign conspire in these activities? Number two, were the communications of officials or associates of any campaign subject to any kind of improper surveillance? The intelligence community has extremely strict procedures for handling information pertaining to any U.S. citizens who are subject even to incidental surveillance, and this committee wants to ensure all surveillance activities have followed all relevant laws, rules, and regulations. Let me be clear. I've been saying this for several weeks. We know there was not a physical wiretap of Trump Tower. However, it's still possible that other surveillance activities were used against President Trump and his associates. Number three, who has leaked classified information? Numerous current and former officials have leaked purportedly classified information in connection to these questions. We aim to determine who has leaked or facilitated leaks of classified information so that these individuals can be brought to justice.
That's House Intelligence Committee Chairman Devin Nunes. Ranking Democrat Adam Schiff wondered why Russian interference seemed to kick into high gear last summer around the time of the Republican National Convention.
Whether the Russian active measures campaign began as nothing more than an attempt to gather intelligence or was always intended to be more than that, we do not know, and is one of the questions we hope to answer. But we do know this. The months of July and August 2016 appear to have been pivotal. It was at this time the Russians began using the information they had stolen to help Donald Trump and harm Hillary Clinton. And so the question is, why? What was happening in July, August of last year? And were U.S. persons involved?
Now, during the hearing, the White House tweeted from the official at POTUS account that Comey, quote, refuses to deny, end quote, that Comey briefed President Obama about calls made by Michael Flynn to the Russian ambassador. Now, FBI Director Comey said he'd neither confirm nor deny that. Trump had fired Flynn as National Security Advisor because he misrepresented his contacts with the Russians, information that came to light due to leaks to the media. South Carolina Republican Trey Gowdy pressed Comey on whether he could assure Americans that he's taking those leaks seriously.
Can you assure them that it is going to be investigated?
I can't, but I hope people watching know how seriously we take leaks of classified information, but I don't want to confirm it by saying that we're investigating it. And I'm sorry I have to draw that line. I just think that's the right way to be.
Well, I'm not going to argue with you, Director Comey, but it is, you know, we're going to discuss a lot of important things today. Whether Russia attempted to influence our democratic process is incredibly important. Whether they sought to influence it is a separate analysis, incredibly important. The motive behind that interference and influence, incredibly important. Our U.S. response, incredibly important. Some of that may rise to the level of a crime. Some of it does not rise to the level of crime. One thing you and I agree on is the felonious dissemination of classified material most definitely is a crime. So I would ask you, and I understand some of the procedures that you are up against, I would humbly ask you to seek authority from whomever you need to seek authority from.
Also in the hearing, Comey and NSA Director Admiral Mike Rogers both said they did not have evidence confirming President Trump's tweets that he was wiretapped by President Obama before the election. Here's Ranking Member Adam Schiff again questioning the FBI director.
The president accused Mr. Obama and presumably the FBI of engaging in McCarthyism. As you understand the term McCarthyism, do you think President Obama or the FBI was engaged in such conduct?
I'm not going to try and characterize the tweets themselves. All I can tell you is we have no information that supports them.
Were you engaged in McCarthyism, Director Comey?
Try very hard not to engage in any isms of any kind, including McCarthyism.
As for the FBI's investigation into Russian election interference, Comey did not say when that investigation would conclude. All of that today from the House Intelligence Committee hearings. They will meet again on March 28th. The Senate Intelligence Committee holds its hearings on March 30th.
So a lot going on today on Capitol Hill because confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee, the Colorado-based Federal Appeals Court Judge Neil Gorsuch, are also underway. The Senate Judiciary Committee considering President Trump's choice to join the High Court to take the seat held by Justice Antonin Scalia until his death last year. President Obama's nominee to replace Scalia, Judge Merrick Garland, was denied a hearing by the Republican-led Senate. Today, Committee Chair Republican Senator Chuck Grassley spoke in favor of Judge Gorsuch, citing his writings.
As he explains, quote, to the founders, the legislative and judicial powers were distinct by nature, and their separation was among the most important liberty-protecting devices of the constitutional design.
But the ranking Democrat, Dianne Feinstein, started her opening statement with what happened with the Garland nomination.
I just want to say I am deeply disappointed that it's under these circumstances that we begin our hearings. Merrick Garland was widely regarded as a mainstream moderate nominee.
NPR's Elsa Chang joins us now from Capitol Hill. Elsa, this is going to take days. Today's statements, not questions. But start with the Republicans. We heard Senator Grassley. Tell us more about their arguments for Judge Gorsuch. What are you hearing?
Yeah, so the thesis that Republicans are pushing is here is an eminently qualified, fair, reasonable jurist who will not inject politics into the rule of law. Grassley, whom you've just heard, talked at length about how judges are not free to update the Constitution. It's not their job. It's the job of lawmakers. Judges cannot substitute their policy preferences, he says, for those of the legislative branch. And what Republicans are also spending a lot of time today doing is countering an argument Democrats are making about Gorsuch, that he has often sided with corporate interests at the expense of regular people. Mm. Republicans have tried to reframe that accusation as, well, when a judge considers cases fairly under the rule of law, he will come to conclusions that are not popular. Those judges who do their job of getting the law right will sometimes side with the sympathetic person and sometimes they will not.
Mm. Oh, and we heard from Senator Feinstein that there's still a lot of anger that President Obama's nominee wasn't even considered at all.
Right.
But what else did she say? Did she talk about what you just alluded to?
Yeah, she absolutely did. She gave quite an outline of the several concerns she has with Judge Gorsuch. First, again, she talks about how he favors corporations too heavily, in her opinion. She talked about a case that many Democrats will be bringing up during this hearing about a trucker who was fired after he left his trailer behind when he was stranded in sub-freezing temperatures. The Tenth Circuit found his firing to be a violation of federal law, but Gorsuch dissented and sided with the employer. Feinstein also talks about her concerns with Gorsuch's skepticism towards what's known as Chevron deference. That's a phrase you'll be hearing a lot this week. It's a doctrine that instructs courts to defer to federal agencies when it comes to interpreting the law. Feinstein says she's concerned Gorsuch will be too hostile to environmental regulations, and she believes that there's a great deal of real expertise in agencies that Congress should defer to, whether we're talking about environmental regulations or financial regulatory policy or food safety. Democrats are also very concerned about Gorsuch's positions on women's reproductive rights. Although he's never ruled specifically on abortion, they point to other cases and his other writings that suggest he might overturn Roe v. Wade if given a chance.
Look, there are political considerations here. Do Democrats want to be seen as a roadblock? And there are also math considerations. Can they do they really have options to block Judge Gorsuch's nomination? So just touch on those questions for a second.
The short answer to that is really no. You know, Gorsuch will need 60 votes in the Senate to get confirmed, so Republicans Republicans will need at least 8 Democrats. There are several Democrats who are up for re-election in states Trump won, so they are facing particularly heavy pressure to let Gorsuch through. And even if Democrats manage it so there are not the requisite 60 votes, you can bet that Republicans in that case will invoke what's called the nuclear option. That is, they will change the Senate rules so it would only take 51 votes instead of 60 to confirm a Supreme Court nominee. So basically, Gorsuch will be confirmed no matter what Democrats do in this particular situation.
Okay. Well, members of the Judiciary Committee will get a chance to start questioning Judge Gorsuch tomorrow. Real quick, any sense of when they might vote?
Chuck Grassley announced that the committee will vote on Gorsuch April 3rd, 2 Mondays from now. And Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says he wants to hold a floor vote on Gorsuch before the Senate's Easter recess, which begins April 8th.
NPR's Elsa Chang on Capitol Hill. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Shoreh Ugdashlu is an actress who surprises. The Iranian-born star won an Emmy for her portrayal of former Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein's wife in the 2008 miniseries House of Saddam. Her simmering performance in 2003 opposite Ben Kingsley in The House of Sand and Fog earned her an Oscar nomination. So where's the surprise? Ugdashlu has also starred in a number of sci-fi projects, from Star Trek Beyond to X-Men The Last Stand to her latest project, Sci-Fi Channel's epic series The Expanse. Set hundreds of years in the future, humans have colonized the solar system in the world of The Expanse. But there's deep political intrigue, shocking corporate malfeasance, the constant threat of rebellion, and hostile alien life. Ugdashlu plays Christian Avasarala, one of the highest-ranking politicians on Earth who, as you'll hear in this scene, will not be bought.
Tell his children that government is more powerful than any corporation. And the only reason they think it tilts the other way is because we poor public servants are always looking for some fat private sector's payoff down the road. But I'm not looking. And by the time they can pull the strings to force me out, it'll be too late. Their family will be ruined.
Well, joining us now is Shoreh Ugdashlu. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So your character on The Expanse has so many great scenes, but I've been told that the one we just heard is one of your favorites. Why is that?
This monologue reminds me a lot of my favorite hero, Elizabeth Warren. And I love the fact that Christian Avasarala is saying that she is a public servant and she's so loyal to her people and to the public.
Wow. So that is not an answer I expected at all. But in a way, it makes perfect sense because politics is such a key and important part of the plot of The Expanse. What is it about the series that attracted you to it?
Its relativity to what is going on nowadays. Although it takes place a couple of hundred years from now, it speaks, you know, about today in a metaphorical way or in a symbolical way. You know, with science fictions and animations, we can be free in what we're talking about without being worried about offending people. We can talk about stories that we are dealing with now if we're not careful today. If we're not worried about losing water on this beautiful earth, then we're going to lose it. We have to import ice from Mars. So it's an amazing platform of the future for us to see what is going to happen if we're not careful with the Earth resources.
Have these political considerations that you're talking about right now, have they always informed your decision and the kind of roles that you've taken?
The day I left Iran, right at the time of the turmoil, I turned myself into an actress with a mission. I always wanted to be a part of a meaningful, substantial storytelling that would be enlightening, educational, and helpful to the people.
Mm. When you say turmoil, you mean the fall of the Shah?
It was, yes, the last days of the fall of the Shah. They were asking for Shah to leave Iran and for the Ayatollah to return to Iran. It was in those days that I decided that there was no place for an outspoken actress like myself and there an Islamic Republic in Iran. Therefore, I jumped into my car February 29, 1979, 4 a.m., and left Iran, driving to the UK.
Driving to the UK?
I did drive to the UK, yes, from Tehran to Istanbul, Yugoslavia. Then I went to Venice, from Venice to south of France, Paris, Paris, Calais, London. I sold my car, I sold my jewelries, and I started studying politics. One thing that I had no knowledge of, and I wanted to get myself educated.
You know, hearing the story of what propelled you to leave Iran and the fact that ever since then you've been an artist on a mission, in a way it's making me look at your remarkable career in almost a brand new light. Where do roles such as when you were on the Fox series 24 back in 2005, you played the role of a terrorist. Where does that fit into your actress on a mission?
It was the first role of a terrorist that I accepted to portray for its versatility and also for its dimensions. She was a woman, she was a mother, she was a lover, she was a terrorist, she was a believer. It was layer after, just like an onion. And I thought, I could be so useful here. Nobody has ever paid any attention to these mothers who are raising these terrorists. Who are they? What kind of a frame of mind they have? And it gave me a lot of courage and the strength and stamina to be able to portray this woman. I'm very proud of this character.
Yeah. Well, so much to talk about with you. I'm not even quite sure where to go next. But let me just back up here because I'm just curious. You actually began your acting career while still in Iran. What drew you to acting to begin with?
Well, I guess it was my mother who was an avid reader and was in love with the Western literature. It was my mother who made me to watch Western films, especially American classics. That's why when I told my mother after watching Gone with the Wind that this is it, I want to be an actor. And my mother said, forget it. And I said, why? Why are you so afraid of me becoming an actress? You go to cinema every day. You read books every night. Why don't you want me to be a part of it? And now I understand. Now that I have a young daughter, she's only 27, now I understand why they were so afraid. Acting was frowned upon, especially for women, back in Iran, and we were talking about 40 years ago.
Well, we have to talk about The House of Sand and Fog.
Oh, my God.
Your phenomenal performance in that movie that earned you an Oscar nomination. I look back on what that movie is about with brand new eyes today because, of course, it's about an American woman who falls down on her luck and through a technical complication loses her house, but also it's about this Iranian family who's trying to pull themselves up as immigrants to the United States. Everybody has a complicated background and there's just a tragic ending, but it's this inadvertent competition for rising back to a place of status and privilege and respect that both parts of this conflict are trying to aim for. It almost seems like the movie was prophetic based on where we are now in 2017, doesn't it?
It's unbelievable. Absolutely. It's a timeless classic. And it was so close to my heart and so close to home. And I think that tragic end has been put there purposefully for the fact that we're doing it again without thinking of the consequences of what is going to happen to us in the future. If we get on each other's nerve, or if you start fighting with one another, this is how the end is going to look like.
Yeah.
It's going to be a tragedy. If we're not taking the right path here, I'm afraid we're going to end there.
Mm-hmm. So let's circle back to The Expanse. What's always attracted me very strongly to science fiction is that multiculturalism is just a fact of so many of these shows and the casts. It's not portrayed as this big deal because it's a reflection of our present and definitely our future. What's it like to be part of an ensemble cast that is so diverse?
Oh my God, it's in terms of diversity, this is one of the most diversified shows of all. We enjoy this so much. We are different backgrounds, nationality, color of skin, accents. We're living peacefully, working peacefully, lovingly next to one another. You see, this is what's been happening in our society for at least a couple of decades. My neighbors here are from Nigeria to the left, Canada to the right, France right in front of me. We've been living, breathing the same air for the last 20 years. We don't see a lot of reflection of it on the silver screen. The reason is because of the fact that executive producers, the studios, cannot trust in us enough to put it on the silver screen. Those who are doing it are now seeing that how beneficial it is to our society to understand that this is not the future. It's now. We're living next to each other and we're working with each other. We're all working for the benefit of the world.
And if I may say, you also get to wear the most fabulous wardrobe on the show.
Oh, my God.
I just had to get that in there. The beautiful, it looks like saris or a little South Asian influence, and you're the most colorful person in every scene.
And I have to thank our designer, Joanne Hansen. I feel like a kid in a candy store when I go to the fitting. Another reason to want to be an actor, to try out all these beautiful costumes.
Finally, your passion for what you do is so inspiring. What about acting gives you the greatest joy?
I think it's the story that brings us all together, be it a theater, cinema, or television. And I like to be a part of a story that will bring light into people's life, that will help us to understand one another and hopefully love each other more than we do right now.
Shorey Ugdashlu is an Emmy-winning and Academy Award-nominated actress. She stars in the Sci-Fi Channel's series The Expanse. She also has a new film on the way. It's called The Promise, which comes out in April. Shorey, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Likewise, thank you so much for having me. Such an honor and a pleasure.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 200 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 500 companies and hundreds of thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Uber confirmed over the weekend that President Jeff Jones is resigning after just 6 months at the ride-hailing company. CEO Travis Kalanick sent a note to staff saying, among other things, it's unfortunate Jeff's announcement came through the press. You could add that what Jones said to the tech website Recode is also unfortunate for Uber. He said, the beliefs and approach to leadership that have guided my career are inconsistent with what I saw and experienced at Uber. Ouch. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News, host of Jill on Money. Her new podcast is Better Off. She is in New York. And Jill, are you surprised at this?
Well, I guess I'm not surprised that there are a lot of changes at Uber overall, but this just 6 months after the guy is announced with a ton of fanfare, I should say,
yeah.
Because CEO Travis Kalanick had said that this was something that was really important to the company. He really made a big deal about the fact that this guy was coming from Target. It was a mature marketing person. And I think that when Jones came on, he really was intended to help repair some of the reputational damage that had occurred at Uber. And man, when that announcement came out and it was reported in Recode what Jones actually said, I think that part was really stunning.
Right. Well, let's list some of the controversies. How the company handles sexual assault, that video of CEO Travis Kalanick yelling at a driver, a number of departures, a vice president, a software engineer, fired over not disclosing sexual harassment allegations from a previous job. And we're just learning today that Uber's vice president of mapping, Brian McClendon, Recode reports, has also resigned, although Uber's saying this is an amicable departure. But tell us more about what Jones says. I mean, this comes as Kalanick, you know, the CEO, has said he needs to grow up, you know, Kalanick does, that he needs to grow up and hire a COO. So tell us more about what Jones said.
Well, I think that when you think about what Jones came into doing, right, he comes in and they say, you know what, we need someone to really help market this incredibly talented guy, but we need someone to help us display that we are more than a kind of rule-evading, aggressive Silicon Valley company. And I think that when you had someone like Jones come aboard, it almost had that, had almost like that Sheryl Sandberg feel, like we need a grown-up to help this company mature a little bit. We have either an aggressive CEO or a shy CEO, someone who we really want to groom. And not, this does not always work. We know that very well. I mean, it happened to work quite well, actually, at Google. And I believe that Sandberg has been amazing at Facebook, frankly. But I wonder what the next step is going to be, because I wonder who wants this job after you see this kind of departure. Yeah. And we also, as you said, we know that they're trying to hire a chief operating officer. And Kalanick himself said, hey, you know, I want to do a better job. This chief operating officer will help me do a better job. And I think it's a little bit too easy to say that Jones left because there was going to be someone hired above him. It doesn't appear to be,
right.
That does not appear to be the problem. The problem appears to be that he did not like the culture of this company, and maybe didn't even like the way that Kalanick was purporting himself, and frankly, maybe didn't have as big an impact as he thought he might. Usually when I smell this kind of a scandal, or not scandal, but story, there's usually something behind the background, which is the guy who was brought in is not being given his voice.
Well, and then there's also the people that feel the drivers aren't been giving their share either. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst, CBS News. Jill on Money, thank you.
Take care.
The state of California is considering a proposal which would officially declare it a sanctuary state and would prohibit state and local officials from assisting federal immigration officers seeking to deport those in the country without documentation. It's a declaration that the state's largest city, Los Angeles, has not made. And L.A. just reelected its mayor, 46-year-old Democrat Eric Garcetti. Mayor Garcetti joins us. Welcome back to Here and Now.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
So first of all, how is L.A. doing?
L.A. is doing superb. We've cut our unemployment rate in half. Our voters just passed the largest transportation and homeless initiatives in the country's history at the local level. You know, businesses are popping up. We have, you know, traffic, and we've got homelessness, and we've got housing prices going up that come with those. But those are good problems to solve when voters are empowering you to actually spend dollars to, you know, build a new city. And I would not rather be anywhere else in America right now. Los Angeles, I think, is leading the way in embodying our values.
Hmm. Well, so, okay, so speaking of those values, let's talk specifically about things like such as immigration. Of course, L.A., a city of many, many immigrants, and you have spoken out about President Trump's executive order on immigration. But if I understand correctly, on the other hand, you've declined to call L.A. a sanctuary city specifically. Why is that?
Well, if a sanctuary city is something in which our police department is not turned into immigration agents, we are, and proudly so. I think there's so much confusion around the issue that others define it as a place that kind of coddles and defends and protects dangerous criminals, which we don't. So in the former, we absolutely are. In fact, we've led the way. And not only do our police officers keep a distinct lane where we do not enforce our immigration laws, that's a federal responsibility, and to do so would not only take away precious police hours, but would undermine the trust we've built with our immigrant communities. We're going further, and we're actually providing a legal defense fund to defend, you know, those dreamers, those military families, and others who may be threatened with deportation under what we've seen come out of the White House. And we should continue to stand up for immigrants. That's our history as a nation and certainly as a city here in L.A.
Mm. But on the other hand, though, I mean, of course, as you well know, the Trump administration has said that it would like to, if necessary, you know, freeze funding to so-called sanctuary cities. I mean, how much would L.A. stand to lose if that happened?
Well, we have about $500 million of our tax dollars that we send to Washington and that come back to us. We're a donor city. We give more to the nation than we receive back from our own income taxes and other federal taxes. That said, we feel on extremely strong constitutional ground that any attempt to do so would violate the United States Constitution. The Supreme Court decided that a couple years ago against the Obama administration when they were trying to force states and localities to expand Medicaid. And the Supreme Court said you can't put a kind of fiscal gun to the head of states and localities to do one policy by taking away money or threatening to take away money from a different area. So I'm encouraging the administration instead to get to the hard work of actually fixing the immigration system and do what Ronald Reagan did in the 80s and have a comprehensive immigration reform package instead of, you know, playing these silly games.
Mm. But just to be clear, the number that you mentioned is $500 million,
yes,
potentially. So that's
$500 million.
Not insignificant for the city.
It's not insignificant. We've heard no threat of taking 100% of this money away. The first, the budget that just came out from the Trump administration, in fact, didn't single out so-called sanctuary cities over others. They decided to take away all funding from all cities because I think they recognize if they pick certain cities that this will be in violation of the Constitution. So they're talking about taking away from all cities reimbursement for some of the jail expenses that counties and cities have today.
Hmm. Now, you talked about voters a little bit earlier. I want to note that voters in LA County just passed a quarter-cent sales tax increase in order to pay for homeless services. You tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was an extraordinary vote. Out here in California, you need a two-thirds vote to pass new taxes. But building on an earlier initiative in November, the city of LA passed about $1.2 billion to be able to house our homeless with 10,000 new units of housing to get people off the streets. The county now has passed this other measure that will give us $350 million a year for the next decade to help give the services to those people in housing. We know it works out here in Los Angeles. You can't put somebody in an apartment who's lived on the street without the mental health services, job training, substance abuse counseling that he or she may need. Similarly, treating people on the street is no solution. They need housing. But we finally got these two measures passed that will allow us to really solve this problem once and for all.
Yeah, so let's talk about the flip side of that, and that is there's been a surge of development going on in Los Angeles, which, you know, for any city is a good thing. But on the other hand, community activists are worrying about the Manhattanization or gentrification of L.A. I mean, isn't that always a pressing worry when you have a surge of growth like that?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, I agree that we always have to balance the growth, which is good, which helps us bring down housing prices over time because you have more units. We have a lot of jobs that want to come to Los Angeles and not enough houses or housing units for people. And we need to build about 100,000 units more, and we're half of the way there. But voters soundly rejected an idea of putting a moratorium on that. I hope this year to pass something called a linkage fee that will require developers, when they're building luxury condominiums and apartments, to put money aside to subsidize housing for the rest of us as well, that would build, you know, tens of thousands of units of affordable housing, which Los Angeles needs. And combined with the measures that we mentioned before on homelessness, we could literally be building more units of affordable housing per capita than any city in America.
Important, right? Because you've got to find ways to incentivize the construction of affordable and middle-income housing. So just as a reality check, what is average rent for an apartment in L.A. right now?
Well, you know, in an area like Hollywood, a studio would start at about $1,100 a month. It's very difficult to get anything under $1,000 unless it's been subsidized. And that quickly goes up. 1-2-bedroom apartments can be in the $2,000, $3,000 range. We have cities with higher rents like San Francisco and New York, but we have one of the biggest, if not the biggest, gaps between average wages mm-hmm. and average rent in America. And so I'm focused like a laser on doing two things, raising wages by, you know, raising our minimum wage, which I led the fight to do, and finding more of those $50 to $100 an hour jobs in infrastructure and key industries like technology. And then second, bringing rents down by building more subsidized housing as well as more market rate housing, because we need it both at the top and the bottom to just have more units. It's a simple supply and demand problem we have right now with not enough units for the number of people who still are excited about coming or staying in Los Angeles.
Yeah. A couple more quick questions, if I may. Crime is on the rise, I think, in a noticeable way. What's your answer to bringing that crime rate back down?
Well, it was one of the safest years in 60 years last year, but percentage-wise, the last 2 years did see an increase, double-digit increase, kind of at the bottom of that hook on a graph. The good news is the last 7 months it's been flat, and the last 2.5 months of this year it's been coming down. We've seen it up and down the West Coast. I think drugs are cheap. That's leading to a lot of people being addicts. We're seeing them living on the streets. A lot of well-intentioned criminal justice reforms in California, which have reduced sentences, are a good idea. But the savings, which were supposed to catch people before they became criminals again or addicts again, has not come to the streets. So we're working very hard to make sure that we have more intervention and prevention, not just more policing. And I think the reason we've turned the corner is Los Angeles is also has really modeled what community policing can look like. And we're putting more officers in neighborhoods for longer periods of time so they get to know the names of young people in the neighborhood and vice versa. That can help us reduce and prevent crime. And then we're expanding all of our youth programs to make sure that young people have safe places to be in the summertime and on the weekends during the school year as well.
Yeah. Now, Mayor Garcetti, You're very bullish on LA, and that is the right of any big city mayor. But honestly, for a second here, just my last question to you is, what do you think is your genuine biggest challenge right now for the city that maybe you're not sure all the pieces are in place for LA to solve?
Well, I think poverty is the biggest challenge for Los Angeles and for many of our cities that have come back from the recession. We can't leave anybody behind, and I always say we can't average out our prosperity. If we did in Los Angeles, everybody could say they were well off. But even though we've cut unemployment less than half of what it was before, about 5% now, in certain neighborhoods, it's still double digits. There's too many zip codes that are the determinant of success. And so I'm, really focused in bringing together those pieces. We have two promise zones, which are the federal programs that begin to attack poverty not just by looking at housing or just looking at education or just looking at parks and health or just looking at our safety, but really pulling all those pieces together. You know, a child drops out of school and then doesn't be able to graduate from college or get a good job for a host of reasons. It might not just be the quality of her education. It might be the violence in her home. It might be the violence in her community. It might be the obesity in her family. And, you know, for us to really be a prosperous city and country, we've got to make sure that we're taking care of everybody. And so poverty really continues to be my driving motivation and force as we see this amazing moment in LA to ensure that it's for everybody and not just most of us.
Well, Eric Garcetti is the mayor of Los Angeles. Mayor Garcetti, thanks so much.
Such a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
At 5 o'clock at night in the New York Daily News, you couldn't see from one end of the city room to the other because of the smoke. A tremendous scene, looked like an old fight club. And the noise of the typewriters was loud, like subway train running through. And out of all this noise, smoke, came nervous energy. Words in a newspaper are made of nervous energy. And they had that.
Pugilistic Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Jimmy Breslin, who died Sunday at the age of 88, speaking in 2004 to reporter John Kalish. For 40 years, Breslin's words punched off New York papers like a prizefighter's left hook, fighting for the little guy and against those who abused positions of power. John produced a radio documentary about Jimmy Breslin. We'll post it at hereandnow.org. John was also one of legions of journalists who learned something from Breslin. He joins us now. And John, Jimmy Breslin wrote about the guy who dug JFK's grave, the gangsters from his native Queens, like the 400-pound bookie Fat Thomas. Start there. How did his hometown, Queens, inform his writing?
Well, he used to write about Queens Boulevard a lot and this joint called the Pastrami King, I think it was called. He, I think, tried to epitomize the little guy who wasn't living in glamorous, slick Manhattan, who lived in an attached row house in one of the outer boroughs. And he was very proud of those roots, even though at one point he was living on Central Park West in Manhattan.
Well, full disclosure, I had the chance to have a small friendship with him and his wife. Jimmy Breslin and I both lost our pants covering a violent story. Me, because I got scared and ruined mine. He, because some guys took his off, and that started a conversation between us. But you met him in the early 80s. Give us a sense of his influence on journalism.
Well, the thing about Breslin is that he obviously was a great writer, but he also was a great reporter. And the year that he won the Pulitzer Prize for commentary, I mean, he had scoop after scoop in the Daily News. He basically blew open this municipal corruption scandal in Queens that resulted in the Queens borough president committing suicide. He was just an amazing reporter. Breslin knew everybody, and, you know, his phone never stopped ringing.
Yeah. After he won that Pulitzer in 1986, he told you this the next day at a party.
I still pursue the art of climbing flights of stairs. Go to the scene. Go ring the doorbell and ask the guy. Nobody does that. It's an art that's going to come back, however.
What makes you think that?
Because of me.
That's the exchange that gave you the title for your documentary, The Art of Climbing Tenement Stairs. But John Kalish, Jimmy Breslin could also be brash, insulting. There is that story in 1990 He came into the newsroom hurling racial and sexual slurs about a young Korean-American colleague. She had registered a complaint about a column in which he seemed to be saying that his wife shouldn't work. And everyone who knew Jimmy Breslin knew that he adored his wife, the politician Ronnie Eldridge. He later apologized for that outburst. But, you know, talk about that side of him.
I was actually around New York Newsday back then when that incident happened. And the thing that really was horrible was that he called this Korean-American reporter a yellow cur, which sent a lot of people to the dictionary. First of all, he may be a giant force in journalism, but he had, at some level, very thin skin and couldn't handle the criticism, so he exploded. Also, the notion that Jimmy Breslin was a racist is kind of absurd because he dedicated his reporting and writing life to writing about people of color. I mean, I remember when he wrote a lot of hard-hitting columns about this African-American woman in the Bronx named Eleanor Bumpers, who was killed by police. And so he was not a racist, but he had thin skin and, you know, warts and all. You got to love the man.
John, towards the end, did he talk about his legacy? Did he talk about, you know, all the scrappy columnists that he begat?
He did. And, you know, there were actually quite a few great Irish-American newspaper columnists who clearly emulated Breslin. One of them is still writing today for the New York Times. That would be Jim Dwyer. He also made a point of making fun of the, you know, new generation of journalists who didn't go to a bar and, you know, discuss language at the end of a hard day, that, you know, they went home and drank wine or, you know, worse, went to a health club and exercise. So that was Jimmy Breslin.
Well, actually, let's leave with the thoughts of Pete Hamill, the great newspaper man as well, and close friend of Jimmy Breslin's.
When I hear people knock him, I always remind them, if he hadn't been here, what would this city be like? What would the newspaper business be like? Because he came along and not simply put a column into a newspaper, but added voices to the chorus of the city. And I think that, above all, is a triumph.
John Kalis, thank you so much.
A pleasure, Robin.
I'd say rest in peace, but Jimmy Breslin would hate that. Too quiet. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.